first meeting of the Legislative Audit Commission on March 5th, 2010. Our purpose here today is to hear a presentation on the program evaluation report on natural resource lands. Nobles.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Jim Nobles. I'm the legislative auditor for the state of Minnesota, and with me at the table is John Yunker, who was the manager of this evaluation. I'd also like to recognize Terry Meyerhoff in the audience, and also Colby Sullivan, who is back here. And as some of you know, Mr. Sullivan is from House Research, and on this project we had the good fortune to have House Research loan Mr. Sullivan to us for this project. And I want to thank Pat McCormick, the director of House Research, for that. It was a very advantageous arrangement for us. So thank you very much, Colby. Well, Madam Chair and members, I think we would all agree that the people of Minnesota enjoy a wide range of benefits from the state owning natural resource land and purchasing conservation easements on private land. State ownership of land and easements provides opportunities for hunting, fishing, boating, canoeing, hiking, camping, picnicking, rock climbing. I'm trying to think of all the things I've done. And there's just a whole host of opportunities available because of the state's ownership of land and easements. State ownership of land and easements also helps protect and conserve habitat, endangered species, and the simple beauty of the Minnesota landscape. And in some cases, state ownership of land also produces revenue for the state treasury and for some units of local government. But providing these benefits obviously costs money, and those costs extend far beyond the initial purchase price of land and easements. The state does not own land or easements just to have a real estate portfolio. We own land and easements as part of programs, and managing those programs and the land and easements associated with those programs can cost a significant amount of money to, for example, develop a park, maintain a wildlife management area, monitor tree growth, and enforce easements. The state also incurs costs by making payments to local units of government for the estimated negative impact of state land ownership on the budgets of local units of government. Because of these costs and the competing perspectives and interests that people have in how state land and easements should be used, natural resource land as a topic can become somewhat controversial. And where there is controversy, there is often a request to the Legislative Audit Commission to authorize an evaluation by the Office of the Legislative Auditor. And that request came to the Commission last year, and you made that authorization. We would be the first to admit that this was a very challenging assignment. It is a big topic, and there are a lot of issues involved. Early on, we decided that we could not evaluate all of the programs, the individual programs associated with state ownership of land and easements. And we made that decision in part because we have conducted some of those evaluations, and we know how challenging and difficult and time-consuming they can be. So we decided that we had to look broadly across DNR and its management of state land holdings, and at DNR and Bowser in their management of easements. And because there was strong legislative interest, we also decided to look in some depth at state payments in lieu of taxes to local units of government. And so before turning to Mr. Yunker, I also want to say to those of you who may not be familiar that this report is the product of the Office of the Legislative Auditor. Even though the Commission authorized this evaluation, our findings and recommendations are the product of the professional work of this office. Members of the Commission just received this report this morning. It's the first time they have had an opportunity to see it, and at least it's been my experience that sometimes not all members of the Commission necessarily agree with every aspect of our reports. Sometimes they do, but I just want you all to understand that this report is a report from the Office of the Legislative Auditor and may or may not reflect the individual positions and opinions of either the members of the Legislative Audit Commission or any other legislators. So with that, Madam Chair, I'd like to turn to Mr. Junker to make a presentation of our findings and recommendations.
Mr. Junker, if you identify yourself for the record, we'll be pleased to have your report.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is John Junker. I'm with the Legislative Auditor's Office. I'm going to first try to highlight some of the key findings of the report and then present a little bit of background about state land ownership for you, and then we'll talk in more detail about the findings of the report. If you recall, this report looked at four major issues. One was to look at DNR's land ownership of land. Another one was to look at DNR's use of conservation easements, as well as to look at the Board of Water and Soil Resources and their use of conservation easements. The third issue that we looked at was whether or not DNR has adequate resources to manage and maintain existing land, and that's become more of an issue in recent years, although it's always been an issue. There always is interest in acquiring more land, and the question is still out there as to whether or not that DNR has adequate resources to manage what they have. And the new constitutional amendment passed by voters, the legacy amendment passed in November of 2008, creates even higher expectations that the state can acquire more land. So I think this is an issue that legislators wanted us to look at and we address in the report. And then finally, we looked at the issue, as Mr. Noble said, of payments in lieu of taxes, because there was considerable interest in that. And we were basically asked to address the question of whether those payments in lieu of taxes to local governments are adequate, more than adequate, less than adequate. How do they compare to some criteria? What we found was that DNR has made efforts to strategically evaluate its land holdings, but we feel that more work is needed. In the easement area, we found that Bowser has a fairly good and comprehensive easement management program, but DNR lacks one. And I think it's important to note, though, that they are in the process of developing one and inventorying their conservation easements and trying to get their program in shape. We did find also that DNR appears to lack adequate resources to manage and maintain existing land, and we make some recommendations in the report. We cannot come up with an estimate for you of exactly how much they fall short, but we make some recommendations in the report that I think will get the legislature that kind of information. And finally, it was very difficult to assess the adequacy of payments in lieu of taxes, and I'll get into that more. But we did find that it would appear that counties receive more than is necessary to offset lost property tax revenue. If that's the goal of PILT, they're getting more than what they need, specifically for acquired non-hunting land. And as we get into PILT, I'll explain all the different types of PILT and why I'm specifically saying this is acquired non-hunting land. So a little bit of background about state land ownership. The state owns 8.4 million acres of natural resource land. This doesn't include conservation easements. This is the land we own outright. And that's about one-sixth of the state. Well, that 8.4 includes 5.6 million acres that are managed by DNR, and that's probably what you usually think of when you think of DNR land. And it also includes 2.8 million acres of tax-forfeited land that is held in trust by the state for local governments. This land, under state law, is managed by counties, and it's largely forested lands.
Excuse me, Mr. Junker. Representative Colbert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just for clarification on your last slide, so are you saying that the 8.4 million acres is natural resource land or total land? In other words, what is included in the 8.4?
Mr. Junker?
Madam Chair, Representative Colbert, that's natural resource land. We don't have a figure for total state-owned land, but I can tell you that this is the vast majority of what the state owns. I don't know that you can come up with a number. It's not easy. And the numbers that are out there don't include things like highway, right-of-way, and so on. So there's no comprehensive number out there. But from what all we can tell, 8.4 is a very significant portion of all the state land, state-owned land out there. This is the natural resource part, and this is what we focused on. If you look at that 5.6 million acres that DNR manages, two-thirds of it is state forests or other forested lands. A little less than a quarter are wildlife management areas or other wildlife areas. And then parks and state parks and recreation areas make up about 4% of the acreage of the land. It's not the value, it's the acreage. 3% of the land that DNR manages include scientific and natural areas, and the other 1% would be all other uses, including trails, water access sites, aquatic management areas, and so on. It's important to keep in mind that for the land that DNR owns, some of this land has been held by the state for a long time. 45% of all the land they manage is school trust fund land. That land was given to the state back in the 19th century by the federal government, and the proceeds from that land, the net proceeds, go to the permanent school trust fund in accordance with the state constitution. 28% of the land that DNR manages was acquired back in the 1920s and 30s. That's the consolidated conservation or CONCON lands. And they were acquired when counties, I think it was primarily tax forfeited land that counties then issued bonds on, drained those lands and tried to make them productive agriculture or other lands. And they were unsuccessful doing that for the most part, and they were defaulting on the bonds, and a few counties were even in danger, I think, of bankruptcy. The state took over those lands in return for taking over the bond payments. And on many of those lands, the state also currently provides some revenues, some share of the revenues to local governments. And I should add here, too, that so when it comes down to it, only about 25% of the land that DNR manages is truly acquired land, land that DNR has acquired through purchase or donation or some other means. That's the land that's currently owned by the state and managed by DNR, but long-range plans that either DNR or citizen advisory groups to DNR have put together anticipate acquisition of significantly more acres. So for wildlife management areas, the citizens advisory plan talks about a 64% increase in acres. For scientific and natural areas, DNR's plan talks about a 240% increase in the number of sites, and so on. I would just comment that regarding state parks, the 21% increase in acres is primarily for the acquisition of private inholdings that are within state park boundaries. And when it mentions new parks, sometimes those new parks are recommended either by the administration or by the legislature. So it isn't necessarily DNR that's recommending those parks, but that's another way in which we acquire more land.
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Yelford, this plan, is this a annual plan, or is this a plan over 10 years, or a plan over, what is the period of time that this acquisition plan you're talking about is to take place?
Mr. Yelford, is there someplace in the report you would direct us to?
There is someplace in the report. I'm trying to remember where that would be. It's in Chapter 3.
Page
38. There's, Madam Chair and Senator Hand, there's a table on page 38 that talks about these long-range plans and what the objective is and by what date, if a specific date is mentioned in the plans.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Yelford. The other question, this the increases that you're talking about, if you added that all together, all the plans for acquiring additional lands, and you're saying right now we've got 8.4 million acres, or I think that was the number, what is the percentage increase in total that we're talking about when you add all this together?
Mr. Yonker?
Madam Chair, Senator Hahn, I haven't tried to add that together, and there is some difficulty in doing that because some of these plans talk about an increase in the number of sites, not an increase in the acreage. I think you should keep in mind, too, here that the biggest area of land ownership for DNR is forestry, and that's where they have the smallest increase, although even a small increase there is a good number of acres. So I haven't tried to add these all up and put them together. It's not possible to do that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Yonker, the DNR long range acquisition plans, would you say those are predominantly due to legislation requests in statute, or are the agency objectives? Do you have a way of clarifying that?
Mr. Yonker?
Madam Chair, Representative Szymanski, it varies. Some of these, like the WMAs and the AMAs, aquatic management areas, are citizen advisory, were citizen advisory group reports that to DNR. I believe the SNA plans, that's a DNR product, as well as water access, and certainly forestry and to some extent the acquisition of private inholdings and parks. Trails, however, we have the legislature authorizes the trail system, and currently the legislature has authorized about 2,600 miles of trails, 1,300 of which, or about half, have been acquired and developed. So I think that's a case in which the legislature has authorized those trails, and the 100% or so increase in miles is a reflection of what's in legislation. If you look at how much land has been acquired over time, though, it's been relatively modest. So if you look over the last 20 years, there's only been about less than a 5% growth in the amount of land DNR manages and the state owns. Most of that growth has occurred with wildlife management areas, some with scientific and natural areas and parks, and it would appear like that there's been maybe a small reduction in the amount of state forest area or forested area.
And Mr. Yonker, that's a net increase, because sometimes state sells land as in your other slide. So this is a net increase over the 20 years. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, there's always some churning. There's land being sold. There's land being exchanged. There's land being purchased. So this is a net increase. And the tax forfeited natural resource land that counties manage has changed very little over the last 20 years. It's about the same as it was 20 years ago. There are always pressures on DNR to both buy land and acquire easements and sell or exchange land. And Mr. Nobles ran through all of the various reasons or a number of the reasons why you would want to acquire land. There's also been pressures to sell land. In 2003 and 2005, the legislature passed requirements that state agencies, including DNR, but not exclusively DNR, sell land use those net proceeds, deposit those net proceeds in the general fund. There have also been concerns that have been raised by counties, and there have been counties who've asked, passed resolutions that ask that there be no net increase in public land in their counties. And that's not just DNR land, but it would include what the counties own and what the federal government owns. So there have been a number of pressures on DNR to sell or exchange land as well. What we found is that in response to those pressures to sell, DNR has tried to more strategically evaluate its land holdings, and they certainly have identified land for sale, and they've sold some land. In response to those two requirements, they've sold about $3 million of land that was applied toward those requirements. Obviously, if they sold trust fund land, that the proceeds could not go into the general fund. The DNR is also conducting a pilot project with Roseau County. I did see someone, a county commissioner from Roseau County, is here. The pilot project is trying to identify where DNR could sell land, acquire land, exchange land with the counties, try to make some decisions jointly with the county to their mutual benefit. And in late 2009, the DNR completed forestry plans, which looked at all of their forestry holdings and tried to identify priorities for acquisitions, sales, and exchanges of land. We would say that the work is not complete. Obviously, there's work still left to be done. The state agencies still have not produced the required proceeds required in 2005 legislation. The 2005 legislation asked that $6.4 million in land and buildings be sold. The last I looked, we were at about $3.8 million. DNR has sold about $2.2 million of that. So they haven't yet achieved that goal. DNR does have another $8.4 million of land on the market right now, and it hasn't sold. And, you know, the market probably isn't so good at the current time, so hopefully there may be still opportunities to sell some of that land. I think one of the other issues that we point to in the report is that you have a checkerboard pattern of public forest land ownership, particularly up in northern Minnesota, that remains an obstacle to efficient management of timber resources. You can have a tract of, remember that counties own, or the state owns and counties manage a lot of natural resource land, and that's particularly prevalent up in northeastern and northern Minnesota. And you can have a tract of county land, a large tract, with a small plot of state land in the middle of that. Or you can have a large tract of state land with a little parcel of county land within that. And forestry would benefit if there were no other reasons to hold on to that land. Forestry would benefit by having a more efficient operation if they could exchange land with the counties and have a more consolidated land holding. There's also trust fund land, school trust fund land in the Boundary Waters Canoe area that produces little revenue because of federal restrictions. This is a long-standing problem. It isn't necessarily DNR's fault. You need federal involvement and you need a buy-in from state policymakers as well. But it's an area of particular concern because it's held in the trust fund, but it doesn't produce much income for schools. There are, in talking to counties around the state, there are other counties that are interested in projects like the pilot project in Roseau County. And there certainly are other counties in Minnesota, at least six of them, that have more state land in them than Roseau does. So I think that's an area that DNR should look at in the future. I want to talk briefly about conservation easements. As Mr. Nobles mentioned, DNR purchases conservation easements on private land. They have a number of different programs. They include trout stream easements, aquatic management easements, wild and scenic river easements, Native Prairie Bank, Forest Legacy easements. The Board of Water and Soil Resources has RIM and other easements. In fact, Bowser has more easements than DNR does. These conservation easements, they preserve land by limiting development or other rights of the private landowner or providing allowing for public access to the property in some cases. But these easements require initial and ongoing diligence by public agencies to protect the public investment in those easements, because buying an easement costs money. Sometimes it costs, depending on the easement, a significant portion of what the purchase price of the land would be. So it's necessary. I think it's good management for state agencies to maintain an inventory of easements, to do baseline reports when they acquire an easement to know what the condition of the property is and what's on the property, and then to do periodic monitoring of those properties and enforcement if necessary. What we found was that Bowser has a comprehensive program for doing that. DNR has not had an agency-wide program. It's managed some easements better than others. DNR, however, is in the process of developing a comprehensive program with help from a legislative grant that was recommended by the LCCMR. They're compiling an inventory. They're developing policies for baseline reports and monitoring. And this is also an area, as we get into the next topic, where DNR is probably going to need more money to do an adequate job of easement management.
Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair, Mr. Junker, you were referencing management of easements. Do you have any information on transparency of easements? Does the Bowser program, can you go on their website and find easements and contrasting that with DNR's? How can the public find easements?
Mr. Junker?
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, I don't have information on that. I do believe that Bowser also received a legislative grant that's going to enable them to do that. I think they're working on that right now.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hansen?
I see we have representatives from DNR. Maybe we can have Bowser speak at the end as well.
If they're here.
As I mentioned earlier, DNR appears to lack adequate resources to manage and maintain existing land holdings. The deficiencies that we're able to see were included development work that hasn't been done, deferred rehabilitation work, inadequate funding, and inadequate funding for periodic maintenance or operations. As I said before, we cannot put a number, an overall number on that, but in the report, there's a table that talks about some of the examples of that, and I've just included some of them here. For example, there's a backlog of activities with respect to scientific natural areas. For state parks, there's at least $54 million in deferred rehabilitation for park buildings and other facilities. For state trail, there's a backlog of $32 million in deferred rehabilitation. For water access sites and fishing piers, $36 million in deferred rehab. For forestry, $8 million for roads and bridges. And there are also some concerns about operating revenues particularly for doing intermediate treatments on trees to maximize the quantity and quality of the timber production. We have money through DNR has money through bonding. It's adequate for planting trees, but it's not adequate for protecting and maximizing the growth of the trees. So it's another area to think about. What we recommend is that DNR should prepare long-range budget analyses for these various areas and compare, and in those analyses, compare ongoing funding needs to existing funding levels. The 2009 legislature mandated that for state parks and state trails, and in November of last year, DNR produced that report, and it's subsequently been used by House committees, and it's been, I think House fiscal staff has done some analysis of the work that DNR did and trying to see how much new acquisition can be done, the kind of acquisition that's in these long-range plans over the years if we also try to take care of our rehabilitation and other needs. We think that once DNR produces these reports, the legislature is going to need to take a look at them and have legislative staff analyze them. And I think you should pay particularly close attention to how DNR defines what its needs are, because there may be things that you agree that these are needs or things that you don't agree. So We're not going to take a position here as to what their overall needs are, both because there's not enough data and information out there now, but because I think people will disagree, too, as to what needs are. Finally, I think they need to do some more basic work with wildlife management areas. If we look at the previous slide, that says that for WMAs, there's an unknown backlog or unknown needs, and DNR needs to assess its management needs. DNR lacks a management information system at the department or division level that tracks the condition of WMAs and quantifies their overall needs. It would appear that they do have needs and that they may not be taking care of the WMAs as maybe they should. They're doing the best job they can, but they need that management information system in order to produce the kind of information that we're talking about. We think that long-range budget analyses will help the legislature better understand the ongoing costs of land ownership, and that they'll also help the legislature balance funding for acquisition with funding for ongoing management and maintenance of existing lands. So let me transition a little bit into the topic of payments in lieu of taxes, which is almost a study in and of itself. About $22 million in PILT was paid in calendar year 2009. Most of the PILT is distributed to counties and townships, but due to the fact that this came under an older law that was in existence prior to the main PILT law that was passed by the legislature in 1979, PILT for acquired hunting lands, and that's WMAs, I believe, is distributed to not just counties and townships, but school districts as well. And there's some question as to why the legislature decided in 1979 to not include school districts for most of the other PILT payments. Some would speculate that it's probably because it was felt at the time that school districts were taken care of primarily through the education funding formula and didn't need to have PILT. Payment rates vary a lot by type of land. They're the highest for acquired DNR lands. Now, this is a little different definition of acquired than what I used before and what DNR uses for its land ownership. Acquired lands here are lands that either were taken off the tax rolls when they were acquired, or by legislative direction, it includes certain CONCON lands. It's a change that was made more recently, or in the I think it was 2000 the change was made. The CONCON lands that are included in the acquired category are CONCON lands that are in state parks, wildlife management areas, or scientific and natural areas. And the reason they were included is because it was felt that they had low income earning potential, and so the PILT payment should be higher for those CONCON lands. Here are the payment rates for acquired land. In each county, the amount of PILT for acquired land is either it's the greater of $5.11 per acre or 0.75% of appraised value. There are 13 counties that get the 5.11, and there are 74 counties that get the higher amount. For acquired hunting land, the state average in this category is over $11 per acre. That's including the counties that get the 5.11. And for acquired non-hunting land, the average in the state is close to $21 per acre.
Excuse me, Mr. Yonker. Representative Schmansky.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Yonker, the appraised values, are those determined at the county level or at the state level?
Madam Chair and Representative Schmansky, they'd first be determined by the price that DNR paid for the land, and then subsequently, when they're reappraised every 5 years, they'd be determined by the county assessor. You can also see here that other land receives significantly less in PILT per acre. Any other DNR administered land, and that's primarily school trust fund land, would also include other CONCON lands not included in the acquired category, receive 64 cents per acre. The reason probably for the much lower payments is that these are lands that were not taken off the tax rolls. School trust fund lands were received from the federal government back in the 19th century, around the time of statehood. CONCON lands, I described the relationship there. Those were tax forfeited lands that the counties essentially gave to the state because the state assumed the county's financial obligations. For tax forfeited land and another category called LUP lands, Land Utilization Project lands, these are lands rented, leased from the federal government over a long period of time up in northern Minnesota. They receive $1.28 per acre. There's a graph that I don't have in the presentation, but I'm just going to direct you to, that's in on page 61 of the report, that kind of shows how PILT payments have done relative to inflation over time. Bottom line is that PILT payments did not keep up with inflation from 1980 to the year 2000. PILT has, what most people see is that PILT has tripled since 2000 due to legislative changes, as well as when the legislature introduced the valuation component on acquired land, there was also significant growth in land values that caused the PILT payments to go up. So that tripling in the last decade was not something that you saw in the first two decades that PILT was in place. If you look at 2009 PILT per acre, it's about 30% higher than the 1980 PILT per acre adjusted for inflation, and that's what you see in the graph, $2.84 compared to $2.16. It's not true that every county has experienced the same thing because they have different amounts of different types of lands. So PILT for some counties has not kept up with inflation over this longer period of time because they primarily contain non-acquired land. It's the acquired lands that have done well relative to inflation. So if you recall, what we were asked to address was what's the adequacy of PILT? The problem is, are there criteria for determining the adequacy of PILT? State law doesn't provide much guidance on that, but I think you might guess that PILT is probably intended to offset the fiscal impacts of state land ownership on local government. So we tried to, in the report, list what those fiscal impacts would be. Some of these apply more to certain types of land than others. For example, is PILT supposed to replace lost property tax revenues when the state acquires land? That's probably more relevant for acquired land than it is for school trust land or CONCON lands. So that's a relevant comparison. It could also be argued that having state land may affect the values of adjacent the property values of adjacent properties, and thus the property property tax revenues of local governments. And it could affect them either positively or negatively. Also, it may be relevant to look at the costs of local government services to lands that are owned by they're managed by either DNR or the counties. Those costs could include road costs, emergency service costs, police costs, fire costs. For some types of land, that's probably the most relevant comparison. For example, for all the other DNR administered lands that receive the low payment rate, that's probably the right sort of comparison. It might also be important to note, even for acquired land, when the state acquires land, does that increase or decrease the costs of providing services? There are other things here as well that may be fiscal impacts, and I'm not going to get into them in detail. Suffice it to say that there are difficulties in trying to measure all these things. There isn't data out there. There aren't data out there that measure the impact on local government costs. There's difficulty in trying to assess what the economic impacts are of the effect of tourism and the like on local governments and their finances. And there's insufficient data out there to assess the impact of state land ownership on adjacent property values. What we were able to do was to look at how PILT compares to the estimated property taxes lost when DNR acquires land. And it's a comparison we had to do by going, not by going property to property, but by making a average comparison for a county and then aggregating that across the state. So it's not something that applies to each and every county or each and every property out there. It's an average. And you can imagine why it may vary across the state. It varies because tax rates change, local tax rates vary across the state. Doing that comparison, however, what we found was that for acquired non-hunting land, that PILT for that newly acquired land is about two-thirds higher than what county town taxes are. So PILT is giving more than a full replacement of those taxes. It's giving an additional amount. And if you think that the purpose of PILT is simply to replace county town taxes and nothing else, then it would seem to be high. I mentioned that county state land is only reappraised once every 5 years. So if land values are increasing, that 64% difference is going to go down over time until the next reappraisal of state land. You'd have to get a pretty big increase in land values, however, to start to get rid of that 64% advantage during that five-year period. Who are the main beneficiaries of this? Remember that this particular type of PILT is distributed to counties and towns. We think counties are, and townships may not be getting a fair shake. Townships, we estimate, only get about 2% of this type of PILT on average. And town taxes, if you look at what percentage they are of the combined county town taxes, are about 19% to 20% of that total. So if that's a fair benchmark, 2.5% is probably too low. And the reason this is the case is that originally the legislature set the amount that townships were going to get, and it was 30 cents an acre and $3 an acre total. Now it's $5.11 per acre or valuation. That 30 cents was 10% of the total. They were supposed to get 10%. When the legislature switched to a valuation measure, townships still continued to get a fixed amount. It's now, with inflation adjustments, it's now 51 cents per acre, or 10% of the 5.11. But the average in the state for PILT, for acquired non-hunting lands, is close to $21 an acre because of the valuation method that was put in place. Townships only get 51 cents on average out of the $21. So I think what our analysis does is raise a number of questions for the legislature. And I think there are things that we can't necessarily decide or make recommendations on because it's not clear exactly what the purpose of PILT is. But I think the comparison we made, if you think that the main reason for PILT for acquired lands is to replace property tax revenue, then there is some question about whether PILT for acquired non-hunting lands is too high. There's also a question here whether or not townships are getting their fair share of PILT for those types of lands. And I think you could also ask the question, and I'm just going to have one more slide that talks about this, about whether school districts should continue to receive PILT for acquired hunting lands. If you recall, the legislature in 1979 changed the law for all other, or implemented a law for all other types of lands and didn't include school districts. And then finally, another question might be that whether cities should be eligible for PILT if state land is in a city and not a township. And there are at least one example of that, and I'm sure there's a few more that I'm aware that might be out there. I just want to say a few words about school districts and how they may be affected by state land purchases. If you look at the school funding formula, and it gets very complex, but it would appear that for the most part, school district revenues are not affected by state land purchases. There are adjustments made in the funding formula that either involve that may involve more state aid being paid to school districts. You could argue, though, that it's possible that there's an impact on school property tax rates, and that could affect voters' willingness to pass a referendum. So how could purchases of state land affect those tax rates? They could affect the tax rates for debt service levies. That gets to be a very complex calculation, and they may be affected slightly by state land purchases. Tax rates for operating levies could be affected if the state is purchasing the house, garage, and 1 acre of land part of ag homestead property, because that is taxed for operating referendum levy purposes. But if DNR is purchasing ag non-homestead or non-commercial seasonal recreation property, that is not taxed, so that would not be affected. School tax rates would not be affected by purchases of those lands. So you can see the PILT gets to be a very complicated area once you start to think about all of the ramifications and implications of state land ownership. Madam Chair, that's the end of my presentation. I'd be glad to answer any questions that the commission has.
Are there questions or comments for Mr. Younger or Mr. Nobles on the report? Representative Hansen.
Mr. Younger, the $22 million in PILT, that's a general fund obligation.
Mr. Younger.
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, I believe it is, and it's also an open appropriation.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would you speculate that most of the state-owned lands are on township roads?
Mr. Younger.
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, in our business, we try not to speculate. So I'm sure that some are on county roads. And some could be even, there could be some boundaries where they're along state highways, too. So I'm not aware of any database that would allow us to get that information.
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
Because it is sort of an important question as to whether or not townships should receive a greater share. Because I don't think townships, and I refer to some of my transportation friends, they don't receive general state aid for their roads, correct? And so they are carrying the burden of having most of the state-owned land, which I suspect they are, along their roads. They probably don't get much compensation.
Any other comments or questions? Representative Hanson?
Thank you. My question deals with school trust lands, which I'm sure nobody is surprised about. But in your report, you distinguish public lands, I felt like, and school trust lands within the boundary waters of the area. Is there any reason in the report you didn't go down that path, except for one slide, for the rest of the discussion?
Mr. Younger.
Madam Chair and Representative Dietrich, you know, back, I think it was 1998, we did a whole report on school trust fund lands, and I think to do that justice, you'd have to do that again. So we didn't try to cover everything in this report. We tried to cover some things and highlight some things, but certainly this is not a complete treatment of school trust fund lands.
Right.
Representative Dietrich.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The reason that I ask is because there just seems to always be a blending of the words school trust lands and public lands. And so so my next question would be, do you think that it is a fair blending, or do you think that they have two different purposes and we should, as a state and as policymakers, always making that distinction between school trust lands and public lands?
Mr. Yonker.
I'm not, Madam Chair, Representative Dietrich, I'm not sure I can answer that question. Trust fund lands, school trust fund lands are owned by the state, but they're managed to the benefit of school districts. So they're a different type of land than acquired land.
Madam Chair, I guess I would just say in response that I think for some purposes you can talk about school trust lands being a part of the state's ownership and management of those lands, but clearly when you get down to certain levels, like with PILT, like with management of those lands, they present some different issues, and obviously the distribution of the revenue, which is a very important factor and has been, as you well know, a real point of contention and controversy, because the idea was that those lands would be managed for revenue. And that's a very important distinction, and it creates a controversy as to how they're being managed. And that's been the issue, I think, as you well know. Are they really being managed for that purpose, or are they being utilized for some of the other programmatic objectives, recreation or conservation and other kinds of things? It's a very thorny, difficult issue, as you know. That's why one of our recommendations was that the legislature set up a special group of people to address this issue and keep it in the forefront and keep that revenue-producing obligation there as an ever-present issue.
Thank you very much.
Any others? Then I'd like to invite Commissioner Halston to the table, and I'm turning the gavel over to Representative Beard. I have another meeting that I need to get to, but Commissioner Halston, welcome to the commission. And I would direct members, as always, to the end of the report where the Commissioner Halston has his responses to recommendations that are that were made throughout the report.
Madam Chair, members, Mr. Chair, I'll make a few comments up front, and then I'll stand for your questions, as I'm sure you have a variety. I will tell you, of all the legislative audits I've had the pleasure of working with Mr. Nobles on and coming before the commission, this one causes me the least heartburn. In that, it points out, and I quite frankly, I felt somewhat bad for Mr. Nobles in the auditor's office, and the charge that you gave him was so broad. You gave him such a broad scoping that it became very clear for them as we sat down at the auditor's office at the very beginning, trying to help them sort through and scope a document where to go and what to do. Because I will tell you that it's a good document. We don't find anything in the document problematic. We don't see anything in here that's gotcha type thing. Actually, to the contrary, it is a validation of many of the things that we have been talking about over the last 6 years, things that we've identified, things that we have been trying to rectify, things that we've been trying to professionalize throughout the document. And many of the recommendations are validations of things that we are currently attempting to do or in the process of correcting or changing throughout the document. But I think to step back just a little bit, it gives us a chance to talk a little bit on a bigger scale. You saw some of the graphs. When you start talking about state lands, the vast diversity of those lands. And the Department of Natural Resources, if you read our letter, the front half of our letter, we talk about the mission that we've been charged with doing in the management of those lands. Quite frankly, you look at a parcel of land, and we're charged with providing three very diverse management goals. For Representative Holberg, her perspectives and values and goals that she asks us to manage for may be for hunting and fishing, recreational use, trail riding on that parcel of land. For Representative Hilty, it might be for economic development opportunities, logging, mining, the economic activity that the public has used from hunting and fishing and trail riding through through tourism. Senator Hahn might be from the pure protection, wanting those lands to be from an ecological system protected and preserved into perpetuity. All of those three values being managed on one piece of land. Those three values being very diverse in their expectations, very diverse in that conflict. It is a significant conflict inside the Department of Natural Resources. It is a significant conflict for the public, who quite frankly looks at us and asks the question, how did you come up with that decision? How did you come up with the decision to do that on that parcel of land? Because they come at it from one of those values, where we're charged by you to manage those for three values. And that's where the conflict in many of the cases come in. The other thing that we need to talk about is, as you break down that graph of the diversity of that ownership, whether it's school trust fund land, CONCON land, acquired land, but go into the acquired land category, state parks and trails, for the purposes in which we acquire or the funds that we get, becomes very rigid in what we're our scope and ability to do something with. Where did the dollars come from in the acquisition of a WMA? Did it come from duck stamp dollars? Did it come from bonding? Did it come from the surcharge, small game surcharge on hunting licenses? The revenue source that we manage that isn't talked about in the report, but the revenue streams where these lands are acquired or where they're managed from become very important also. So I would caution you when you look at the report and read the report, it is a very simple approach to a very large and very complex, and we really actually need to dive into the very specifics. As Representative Dietrich pointed out with school trust fund land, it is a very specific, and yes, many of the components around it come in, but at the same time, we can hone in and focus our attentions as a report more clearly and give much better information to you, the policymakers, direction to the agency in how to follow through.
Mr. Commissioner, while you're collecting your thoughts, could I pose a question? You're going to call some other folks up here in a moment to testify. I'm thinking specifically about where in the report where Mr. Noble and Yonker touched on Bowser and the DNR and management of easements. Not so much the difference in style, because I'm not conversant in this area of legislative activity. My first thought was, wow, we've got two organizations doing kind of the same thing. If your member or someone from your staff could speak to what's the same, what's different, and could we have one organization doing everything instead of splitting it up? Would that be productive, or are there different purposes, and so on and so forth? Just a
sure. And Representative, Mr. Chair, I think what you're it's a great question, and it gets into the complexity of what's going on. Conservation easements as a tool are, quite frankly, relatively new, a new tool, but they have been used, you know, over the decades. And when I say a new tool, in the worlds of conservation management, easements being a new tool, it's in the last couple of decades that they've come in as a new tool that we identified this problem a couple of years ago, looking back at the easements that we had acquired and recognizing that the diversity of those easements and the purposes for those easements, we didn't have a good tracking system. So we began developing those protocols. We are in the process of developing a lands record system that is very big, very complex database system. There was information we just could not go and identify of some parcels that we bought a couple years ago. But 2 points. First one, there has never been a national standard on easements until 2004. There were no standards in the easement arena for conservation easements until 2004. It is when we start to try to apply the principles and we go to things that were acquired years ago, they may not meet today's standards. We recognize that, and we agree with that. And I think Mr. Jaskey from Bowser, he will talk about the easement programs that they use. They have a lot more easements, but I think they're much narrower in scope. I think, John, would that be correct? They're much more narrow in scope, where we're using diversity of easements, diversity of programs for different reasons, and that's where we get into some of the complexity. But we have we requested resources from the LCCMR Commission to help do that inventory, develop those processes, and we are implementing those, or in the process of implementing many of those things. And that's where I talk about the validation. The report validates many of the things that we identified years ago and are able to now, or begin now, to start providing that type of management. And quite frankly, that type of management that we're hoping to use more in the future to succeed on the goals and objectives that the advocates of our citizenry who want us to do this work and the direction that you ask us to take also.
Senator Hand has a question. Commissioner Holson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Commissioner. Thank you for your work that you've been doing and for your presence here. I appreciate your response and reading your letter and some of the comments you made earlier about the diversity of the mission that the department has and the likelihood, but certainly the opportunity for there to be maybe conflicting goals in the attempt to satisfy the three different missions that your department is responding to. And I know from some of the work on the school trust fund lands, one of the issues had been, is there appropriate focus being brought to managing those lands for the financial benefit of schools? And so, and I don't want to get too far afield from where the report has taken us, but it occurs to me, I ask, is the mission that you're outlining here, is it doable? Or does it present too many conflicts and shifting priorities depending on maybe the whims of the legislature and what we are focusing on at one point or another? And should this mission maybe be divided? Maybe there needs to be a part of the DNR that is broken off that's focused on managing the school trust lands, for example. Mm-hmm. For financial purposes or something. But I don't know. Yep. Any comment on that?
Mr. Christian?
Senator Hunt, that is a great question and one of the questions that we ought to be asked regularly. And I will tell you from my assessment, in having been on that side as a former member of the Audit Commission, chair of the Finance Committee, and now as commissioner managing these arenas, sometimes I ask that question myself. Is our mission too complex for our ability to truly succeed? Is it too diverse for the public to understand? Because if the public can't understand it and why we make the decisions, can we truly succeed? But then I look at, so you take that premise of taking the Division of Forestry and making it a separate entity, Division of Parks as a separate entity, Fish and Wildlife as a separate entity. And the answer I keep coming back to is no. Because by integrating that work, by integrating wildlife and the work that wildlife does for grouse habitat, deer habitat, moose habitat, bear habitat, it's all done on the forest landscape. Not all, but in many cases done within the forest landscape. So that work that the Division of Forestry does, if we apply those three principles together, manage that forest for economic opportunities, manage that forest for the recreational opportunities, manage that forest for the protection values that we're looking for. We're able to bring those values together, work across those boundaries, and service the public in a better way. Now, when you enter into the discussion of, well, how should that apply to school trust fund lands? It's true. Trust fund lands, the revenues generated in the management of that should be for the primary, is for the primary purpose of school children, and we hold true to that. But we're also given the direction by the legislature to manage them in a sound ecological value, sound ecological system. Well, that brings another part of that value into play that you've directed us to manage it that way. We can change our direction. And that's just is going to become the policy question that you are going to be ultimately struggling with and have struggled with school trust fund land management for, quite frankly, decades.
Commissioner, Representative Hansen has a question.
Commissioner, I wanted to shift to the tax portion of the report. And I think it's very timely to get some ideas there on reform, because obviously the governor's budget has some cuts proposed to PILT. And you've had the opportunity to look at the report for a while. It seems that, you know, we have the appropriations that come out of this finance area, but we also have the tax implications mm-hmm. with the revenue department. So my question is, are you or will you be working within the administration with the revenue commissioner? And it looks like we've got an education piece here as well, with the education commissioner or even elsewhere in the administration to look at these recommendations, because it seems, and just reading this over the last couple hours here, that there's an opportunity for a reform of PILT and some recommendations mm-hmm. that could be forthcoming.
Mr. Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, I will, to be quite frank, we did not, as an agency, spend a lot of time in the PILT arena, in the PILT chapter. It's not the DNR's arena. Those are legislatively formulated. They just happen to be coincide with that state ownership of those lands. So the policy discussions have not, those are not part of DNR's arena. It's a very loose confederation. Obviously, by data, we're involved. But the policies around it, that we're more than happy to sit at the table and work and try to provide some perspective with the administration or the legislature, but those are decisions that are not controlled or managed by the DNR. Those are we'll provide whatever information we can, but I don't know if it's appropriate for us to be giving recommendations on the payment in lieu of taxes arena.
Representative Hansen.
But they are part of your budget arena.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, the dollars are appropriated to the DNR and transferred to the Department of Revenue, who manages the allocation. Like I said, it is a legislatively formula-based. It's not even a grant. It's just a way that you transfer the money. You would send it to us, and we transfer it out. The decisions have been made.
Further questions?
I'll just
comment.
The difficulty there is that I realize that it is a transfer, but we have the budget in front of us where we're going to have to cut here in the next literally probably a few days. Mm-hmm. And so what I'm asking is if there's an opportunity to work with those folks in the administration, revenue, education, et cetera, because we now have different information or we have some suggestions here to help overall with the overall budget we're going to be facing.
Mr. Holston.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, we're more than willing to sit down and help anybody come up with recommendations. It's just, I want to be clear, this is not an area of our expertise. It's not an area. The values that you have placed on those formulas and what payments to provide, it's a very loose connection to us. And I'm not trying to duck it, I'm just trying to say, don't look for recommendations from us. This is, you're talking to a group of people who, that's not our area of expertise. I understand it's within your legislative budget scheme. I understand that. It's just within the DNR. It's not ours.
You pretty much do what we tell you to do in that regard. Then, correct? We set the parameters, you perform pretty much.
We don't even perform. It's a... It's a push of the button from your
here to there. Okay.
Money came in, we push the button, and it goes out to the revenue. But there are significant policy debate items that you have had over the years, and I think the report provides the opportunity for some of those debates to occur again. Okay. And we're happy to provide you the data and the information.
Before I call on Senator Roebling, Commissioner Holston, there are several other names on the list here. Are they resources that are available, or are we expecting every one of these people to appear and speak? Lori Martinson, Bob Meyer, Larry Kramka.
Those are members of the department. No, they are not expecting to speak unless you have detailed questions you're looking for.
OK. Okay, well, they're available then if we have specific questions for their areas of expertise. Thank you.
Yes.
Representative Roebling. Senator Roebling, excuse me. I am so sorry.
Commissioner, Mr. Yonkers had mentioned that the DNR has achieved about half of its goal of land sales. And I certainly understand how bad the market is right now. But I'm wondering, I don't live anywhere near where this land is being sold. But how does the average person become aware of DNR land sales? How do you market land? Mm-hmm. What process have you used? Is it strictly through a state website, or do you work with realtors, or how do you actually do it?
Mr. Fisher?
Senator Roebling, I may have to defer that to Marty Vadas, who's the director of our lands division, who manages that activity.
This is Marty Vadas?
This is Marty Vadas. He's the director of our lands and minerals division.
While he's coming, Senator Roebling, let me confess that I'd even felt strange coming off of my tongue that way. Sorry about that again. Mr. Vadas, welcome to the committee. If you identify yourself for the taped record, that'd be good.
Sure, Mr. Chair. I'm Marty Vadas, and I'm the Director of the Lands and Minerals Division of DNR. And Mr. Chair and Senator Roebling, we do have a DNR website that does have the parcels that are up for sale in our semi-annual auctions that are available through the website. But we also do some advertising in local newspapers in the counties that the land is for sale to notify people of that and to direct them for the details to those websites.
A follow-on question while you're here.
Mr. Chair. We also put signs up on each parcel that's for sale so that people in the area or driving by also are made aware of it, and that has phone information and website information as well.
Senator?
Mr. Chair, I was just curious because I know there's people in my area that look for hunting lands, and does it then describe what the land can be used for, if there are restrictions on it and what it's available for. And so I could direct people to the website, to the auctions. I guess I'm not very familiar with how it works.
Mr. Vadas?
Mr. Chair, Senator Roebling, we do have a fact sheet, a two-page fact sheet for each parcel that we put up for sale, and it describes the location and the acreage and the general description of what kind of land it is, whether or not there's legal access to the parcel, and some pictures. And all of those are on the website, and you can go to that and download that particular kind of information for each parcel we put up for sale. And just so you know, I believe it's June 23rd is our next sale of DNR-managed land, and that'll be in Grand Rapids, and on June 24th in St. Paul office will have an auction as well.
Representative Hansen.
Mr. Vadas, I want to switch to the other side rather than the sale, but the acquisition. Do all the acquisitions go through lands and minerals?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, yes. Lands and Minerals is responsible within DNR for doing the acquisition of lands. Lands and Minerals does not select the parcels to be acquired. That's done on a priority basis by the programs that get appropriated the funds. So they're picking the quality of land that they'd like to acquire. And once that selection is made, then Lands and Minerals goes about the business of doing the acquisition.
Mr. Hansen, Representative Hansen.
Do you know off the top of your head how many acquisitions you have pending?
Mr. Vadas?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, I do. We have 256 appraisals or acquisitions that are in process at the moment. And in any one year, DNR would acquire between about 90 and 140 individual parcels. Last year, for example, we acquired 115 parcels, and the cost of that was around $21 million. That might be too much information, but it varies a bit from year to year depending on the size of the parcel, the values of the parcels that we acquire, but that's a sort of a range.
Representative Hansen?
Of those pending, just rough estimates on how many are trails or how many are parks or how many are... And we could get that at another time.
Mr. Chair, I don't have that detail, but it would be safe to say that it's a variety of the kinds of lands that we acquire. And if you think of the appropriations or the dedicated funds that we receive for that purpose, that's sort of the rough mix that you could look at on what we acquire. So if we receive more in bonding for one particular program in a year, that would, we'd be having more parcels from that program.
Okay, Representative Schimansky. Okay, Representative Schimansky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jumping back to the land sales again, Mr. Williams, when parcels are sold, are there any deed restrictions attached, or does the, in essence, a parcel sold, is it full unencumbered ownership?
Mr. Bates? Commissioner?
The answer is yes. There, many are sold free and clear. There are some parcels, if there is a unique character that we're trying to do something like an easement, a road easement, that there would be some deed restrictions. So it's yes. The lands that are identified, they are sold, some with those restrictions if they're needed. Others, many are not.
Representative Hilty, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Davis, there hasn't been any mention in the auditor's report that I've been able to find regarding mineral rights. Could you just give us a brief overview of how that process works and what the implications are for budgetary purposes?
Mr. Bates?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilty, sure. The state of Minnesota owns about 12 million acres of mineral rights. About 3.5 million acres of that are school trust fund. And the majority of those mineral rights are through tax forfeiture. When land forfeits for failure to pay taxes, the state retains the mineral rights if the surface is resold. And so the state, through the Commissioner of DNR, has the authority to lease those mineral rights. And generally, we do that through a lease sale, and it's an annual sale. And we take nominations of areas to put up for bid, and we do that. And for example, this past January 12th, we opened 130 bids from six different exploration companies and mining companies. And those leases then were awarded this past week through the State Executive Council. That's part of the requirement on state-owned mineral rights, is that they're awarded through the Executive Council. And so we now have those lands under lease to private companies for exploration. And the revenues go to whatever the source of ownership of the land is. For the school trust land, the revenue, the net revenue from that leasing goes to the permanent school trust fund. For tax forfeit land, 80% of the revenue goes back to the county, and that's apportioned by law between the school district, the township or city, and the county. And so Concon lands, for example, are 50-50, where the state general fund receives 50% of the revenue and the county receives 50%. So that's all managed through state statute, and that directs where the revenue goes.
Follow on, Mr. Representative Hilty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Reyes, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is that there are situations in which there's privately owned land in which the mineral rights are still state-owned. Could you describe for me what the rights of the property owner are with respect to mineral rights and exploration in those circumstances?
Mr. Bates?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilty, be glad to. If you think of it that each piece of land has two separate titles, one is the surface estate and one is the mineral estate, and most of the time those titles are together, but they can be owned separately. The mineral rights can be severed from the surface interest, so you have a situation where someone owns the surface and someone else owns the minerals, and that does happen in our state. And if it happens to be that those are state-owned mineral rights with private surface, the state has the authority to lease those state mineral rights, but it's not, and that does happen as well. And so we have a situation where you have a private owner and state mineral rights, and our lease provides that the leaseholder needs to work with that private surface owner to get permission to gain access. The state lease does not give them the right to go on the land without the private landowner permission. And essentially what they need to do is they need to make a deal with the surface owner. They need to have an agreement to have the access, and often there is some sort of a payment that's made for the use of that surface to explore the mineral rights. And I'm not sure if that answers your question, but the state mineral lease does not give a company the unilateral right to use that surface. We'd like to see the state minerals explored, and so we'd like to see that cooperation between the company and the landowner, because that's the only way that that will happen.
Thank you.
Follow on. Senator Roebling.
That's some interesting information. I was trying to picture how someone could own the mineral rights underneath and get at them if somebody else owned the surface rights, especially if you were talking about a mining operation. That would be very complicated. And does that set up a lot of conflict?
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Bates, I'm sorry.
That's not the goal. There have been instances where the private surface owner has been not interested or unwilling to issue that agreement with a company for exploration. And our experience has been when that happens, then the company drops the lease and moves on. If there isn't that interest or cooperation. But I can tell you it's often, if you look at these sorts of agreements, very much in the benefit of that surface landowner financially to enter into such an agreement, because should anything eventually be found, that surface becomes extremely valuable. And so there are those instances where people just aren't interested in that, so really then nothing happens.
Senator?
I was just wondering about land acquisition. Do you have any estimate of how much acquisition is done by willing sellers and how much is done by eminent domain?
Mr. Bates?
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, the DNR, in my memory, has only entered eminent domain a handful of times, and it was a friendly condemnation sort of a situation. So I would have to say that 99.9% is willing seller situation. And the friendly condemnation would be something like if DNR itself wants to acquire some school trust land, they would condemn the surface, and that would go through a condemnation action just to ensure that the trust fund is adequately compensated. I can't think of any instance where DNR has tried to use eminent domain to acquire land from a private landowner in an eminent domain. Kind of a typical eminent domain type situation.
Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, I know that we're running a little bit late. We still have the topic selection for next year's process to start, but I wanted to see if Mr. Jashke could come up and maybe a little bit on the conservation reasons, compare and contrast on approach.
And Mr. Chair, just real briefly, just closing, I think it's important to point out you ask the legislative auditor to do a program audit. Mm-hmm. To step into land management isn't a program. It's unlike anything else I think you've ever asked him to do. When you start talking about land management, the variables associated with, normally when you're doing a program audit, it's government entity to government entity, people to people. This is people trying to affect what's happening on a natural landscape and the variables of weather, the variables of disease, the variables of invasive species. Change and the goals and the objectives are very different. So it's very hard to do a program audit on land management. It's not a program. And you need to divorce yourself of that thinking. It's a little bit more complex.
Thank you for your remarks, Commissioner Holston. If you'll be available for just a few more minutes here, we're going to hear from John Jashke, Executive Director of Minnesota Bowser, what we call Bowser affectionately. Mr. Jashke, welcome to the committee. Even though you're not the subject of the report, you may be subject of a few questions. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As Commissioner Holston said, our easement program is in fact a program. It's prescribed in statute. It has its own set of state rules, and we have policies that have been adopted. And so as he was saying earlier, our easement program, our Reinvest in Minnesota conservation easements are much narrower. They have these characteristics as I would describe them. They're all aimed at marginal land, agricultural land restoration, so the majority are all in the agricultural landscapes of Minnesota. There's a few exceptions to that, but certainly they're all aimed at that kind of landscape. And they are also, the vast majority are perpetual easements that were accomplished for the purpose of restoring a wetland. That's, again, the vast majority of those easements are for that purpose. The other thing I can mention, in the last few, maybe decade or so, we've had a federal partnership for the vast majority of those that we've acquired. So we've had a payment that is combined with a state contribution to acquire a perpetual easement that has a federal component underpinning either a contract or a temporary easement that the federal government also holds. So just sort of a capstone of the program is that, you know, we have to make sure we have a good site selection and design as the very beginning of it, because if we're successful in creating a good site, the management long term, of course, is minimized. And so that's one of the things that we look for at the very beginning. We have the ability to be very selective because there's very, very many opportunities out there from willing landowners to seek restorations of wetlands because, of course, the landscapes in those agricultural settings have had a great deal of wetland drainage over the centuries. We have a compliance program that is done through our local soil and water conservation districts. They inspect each of these easements on average once every 3 years, or do a third of them each year. We also use those local districts to work with landowners in terms of signing up interested parties and doing some preliminary design work on those properties to make sure they're ready for a long-term wetland restoration. We also have, on a much less volume basis, done some biological sampling of these sites. We've done a program in the last few years where we have a team in the summer go around and look at a few selected sites and try and sample those to see what our biologic integrity is of these sites, because that's the long-term public benefit that we're actually pursuing and purchasing on those landscapes. And as the commissioner alluded to, we've got a data system as well. We've had, you know, for years since the program began, a paper and database program, but thanks to LCCMR funding in the recent years, we've upgraded that to make it GIS compatible, so you can actually see the maps of landscapes right on the computer system, and our local governments can access that as well as we can to kind of do the monitoring of the time frame for the inspections and to record any kinds of problems or site-specific investigation information. And then, as Representative Hansen noted, we've also got a sort of a version 1.0 of a web-based tool where the public can go in and see where these landscapes are and identify the location of where those easements have been acquired. And so with that, I'll stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Jaski. Members, questions for the testifier? The chair has one, Mr. Jaski. So I'm given to understand that the easements that you catalog, manage, acquire, so on, are probably for a pretty homogenous purpose, where DNRs might be quite a bit different, more varied. Is that what I'm understanding?
Mr. Chair, I think that's exactly correct. They've got a much, much larger array of different sites where they're securing easements. Ours are, as I said before, you know, prescribed very much at these marginal agricultural lands where we're restoring a wetland.
Okay. Further questions for Mr. Jaski?
Thank you.
Seeing none, thank you. Members, questions for any other DNR folks that are here? Or should I, Representative Szymanski?
Mr. Chair, thank you. May I ask Mr. Younger to come back to the table?
Certainly.
On page 33 of the report, sticking to conservation easements, and then it goes into third-party agreements. And just wanted to ask your evaluation of third-party agreements in acquisition of easements and fee title land.
Mr. Younger, you under.
And the question, Mr. Chairman,
restated.
Page 33, 34, you have a recommendation that the DNR does not appear to have formally adopted a proposed process and criteria of department policy regarding third-party acquisitions.
Mr. Yonker.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Szymanski, we didn't do a thorough look at third-party agreements and all the ramifications. There are other issues related to what kind of acquisitions are we doing through them, but this was more a look at the process and the, kind of the formality or informality of how third parties and DNR agree as to financial implications and what costs will be paid by DNR and so on. And essentially DNR says they've adopted, that they are following a particular policy that was outlined in a memo from Mr. Vadas to senior management in DNR. And all we're saying is that you should formally adopt that policy. That memo presents these things as a proposal. Go beyond saying you're following that memo, adopt them as a formal policy. And DNR's response in the back of the report is to say that they intend to adopt them in an operational order.
Good. Thanks. Further questions? Representative Schmansky.
I would like to ask the DNR if they would like to comment on that third-party acquisitions and how that's working. The reason I'm asking is, in my area, there's a little concern on behalf of the counties and farmers, if you will, about competing bidding, for land that may go into a DNR holding in one method or another.
But Mr. Holston, your question specifically, representative, to
the third party
acquisition. Yeah. You know, does somebody else? You want to handle that, Marty? Why don't you?
Mr. Vadas, welcome back. Do you need the question restated, or do you
Mr. Chair, I think it revolves around the fact that there are third-party partners with DNR that we work with to acquire land, and DNR eventually gets ownership of that land in the process. And I can tell you that Mr. Yonkers is correct. I did write a memo to senior managers, and he points out it was a recommendation. We actually have been following that, where we work within the DNR, and we were concerned over a couple of things. One is the selection of the parcels to be acquired. DNR, for all the land that DNR acquires with legislative appropriations, has a vetting process where we go through and do a selection through our divisions that have authority for, say, WMAs or whatever, and we then put that through a screening through our regional offices so that all of the divisions of DNR can weigh in on the priority of that particular acquisition to support the goals of DNR's management of land. And so we weren't doing that with third parties. Third parties were coming forward with parcels, and I think it's safe to say there was a little, if any, scrutiny of that beyond perhaps a local wildlife manager or something like that, so we changed that. Now all parcels that are acquired through third parties go through that same process that we use for lands that DNR is acquiring, just to ensure that it is a priority and it is something that DNR wants to acquire. So once we do that, we have an affirmative letter that we send to that third party saying, yes, DNR wants to acquire this land. And then there's the question of sort of the business aspect of the acquisition. Who's going to do the appraisal? DNR needs to be named as one of the clients of that appraisal if we're going to eventually receive that land. And so we've laid that out in a memo that needs to be agreed to ahead of time on who's going to do the appraisal, what the process is going to be, and if there is going to be any sort of payment by the state to the third party for any aspect of the work that they're doing, that needs to be agreed to ahead of time and documented as well. And so it was an attempt to give some prioritization to those acquisitions and perhaps bring a little more business aspect to the acquisition so it was more straightforward and open for everyone.
Okay. Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good.
Senator Roebling?
One question. Commissioner, a big part of this says we have to be careful how much we acquire because we don't have the money to maintain it. And I'm wondering, do you have a ratio when how do you look at that? Or when do you say, we have to stop acquiring because we have to maintain what we have? How do we make that decision, or is it mostly legislatively driven? How does that occur?
Mr. Quister. And that's where I'm going to have to ask you, we need to start focusing in on which aspect of land management are we talking about. Are we talking about our trails? Are we talking about our forest management? Are we talking about WMAs? It all starts to play in. We also have to talk about, you know, the report characterizes that we don't have enough money to manage our lands. And what we really have to take that analysis a little deeper and break down needs versus wants. Our wants, our appetite for wants, and many of the advocates in the room is very great. When we start talking about raw land or native natural land management, that's where the variableness comes in. There are, if your primary purpose is water quality, our management costs would be very low. If yours is timber, maximizing timber revenue, our management costs are going to be higher. We have to start breaking down to really get at your question. We've got to break it down much finer to what area we're talking about. When we're talking about parks and trails, we know what our deferred maintenance costs are because we're talking about buildings, bricks and mortar, pavement of trails. We can develop a formula for every so many years we need X many dollars to repave the trails. We know, just like at your home, the life expectancy of our water heaters, the life expectancy of the shingles on our roof. We built that in, and we've got that formula, and we've got that type of analysis. Parcel by parcel of natural land, the variables are too high.
Mr. Chair.
Senator.
You know, as I think about this, when you hear that the state owns 1/6 of the land in Minnesota, 8.5 million acres, and I'm thinking of farmland because that's kind of where I come from, and I think of a 200-acre farm, and I think that's a nice parcel of land. You know, in South Dakota, we have 5,000 acres of land, but I think if we own 1/6 of it, you would think there would be enough public land for every purpose. Every need should be able to be satisfied if you have 1/6 of it. And yet we do hear about all of the additional demands, and most of it's for recreation, I think, right now. I don't know if the forestry industry is clamoring that loudly or the mineral industry, but recreational enthusiasts are the ones who usually want more public lands. And I'm just thinking, is there a way to convert what's already owned into what the public is demanding so that there's more of that available where the high demand areas are? How can we make these uses more compatible with each other so that they get both on the same piece of property? And I know you talked about the conflicts.
Yeah.
I understand that.
Mr. Chair, Senator, when you start to look at the distribution of that ownership, you start to recognize that public land ownership is predominantly in northern Minnesota. When you start to look at that, coming from farm country, you'll understand this. Not all land is equal. Some lands can produce a much different bushels per acre than the farm right next to it, and it's all based upon that quality of land. When you look at the state's actual land ownership and that quality, compare it to, say, county tax forfeit. County tax forfeit was land that was owned by the public at one time. Somebody chose to own it, and for whatever reason, it went tax forfeit. Ours were the ones that the federal government didn't want. From a productive side, they're not necessarily the highest productivity of lands. Many of them are bog lands, very, very nice, high-quality natural resources lands, but they're not timber revenue generating. They don't produce a lot of game wildlife. Public access is extremely limited because of it, of the wetland nature of it. So you just need to start, we need to start trying to put things into perspective. You're correct. Much of the acquisition activity that we're engaged in is in the highly privatized landscape. The parcels that we're trying to prioritize are ones that are marginal for economic development from landowners. These were drained wetlands. They are marginal in that. The values that we are asked to acquire those lands calls for habitat development for wildlife. It's water quality for both surface and groundwater. We're bringing those values, multiple values, together and also to provide for public access. So, yes, we're looking at it, and you can look at it from the perspective of recreational access, because we want recreational access. We'll also look at it from the economic development opportunity that WMAs provide us, in that by generating high-quality wildlife habitat, that will generate hunting opportunities, recreational opportunities, tourism dollars. There's economics that are generated within communities as a result of that, and the protection and water quality aspects that they're able to bring. So we're trying to bring all those values together within our acquisition program. And I will tell you, one of the things that administratively that we're doing is we are realigning two of our divisions. Our waters division, which is our hydrologists, the science of hydrology, how that water moves off and through, and our ecological services division, which is our ecologists, that plant and animal regime, bringing those two together to help us prioritize our future acquisitions and influences within watersheds. We're going to be able to, that group and that group of scientists are going to help us prioritize much greater than we're able to today, those future acquisitions.
Thank you. Members, we do have another meeting following this one. Further questions, comments? Seeing none. Mr. Nobles, do you need to make any concluding comments before we accept your report? Thank you for your fine work.
Just to thank the commission and the commissioner and his staff for being here. They've been very cooperative, and we appreciate the way they've been receiving this report. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Members, thank you for a thorough vetting. This meeting is adjourned. You did adjourn.